Thank you, Mamuka. It's always a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to be talking about the impact that Russia's designs for the security architecture of Eurasia would have on the Caucasus and Central Asia in particular. Now, as you may know, in the news now, we see that the Russian government is sending out all kinds of signs that it wants to talk with Washington and the European Union about some sort of European security formula, which would obviously allow Russia to hold on and legitimate its conquests, that's what they are, in Ukraine, and to have the West formally acknowledge everything that Russia wants the West to acknowledge, and that would create a kind of floor, if you like, or a new basis for a relationship. So in many cases, particularly in journalistic comments, since there are no academic articles, it takes too long to write one about this so recent a phenomenon, we see talk about a new Yalta and Tehran. And that's really very much what the Russian government is after. They are after a bilateral deal. I emphasize bilateral, with either Europe or the United States or the West collectively, that would legitimate all their aggressive actions up till now and essentially say, you know, this is your sphere of influence. We have ours, you have yours, and so on. Now, this is wholly consonant with Russian thinking. Some of you in the audience were yesterday at the program at the Kennan, where we had a Russian speaker say about what does Russia really want. Russia is obsessed with its status as a great power. It either is or believes it ought to be a great power. What does that mean? It means, to be blunt, empire. And unfortunately, in the 21st century, empire, even informal empire, means war. And Russia is a country that has been at war for 20 years. Even if it has not invaded Ukraine last year, the war in the North Caucasus is 21 years old. The war in Georgia is not over. It's basically an armed truce. Ukraine is now a third front or a second front, because the North Caucasus is the MVD rather than the army, and it's domestic. This idea of great power, of Velikaya Dzhava, first of all connotes empire. And it is necessary to understand, if you're going to understand Russian security policy and the demand for a, quote, new security architecture, that the leadership of the Russian state, not just Mr. Putin, but the elite, because there's a consensus on this, firmly believes that Russia ought to be this great power, that is the system-forming state in a world order that controls a continental bloc, and as a result of that, is totally free and sovereign and independent to do as it wants, much like the autocrat at home is completely non-accountable to anybody for anything. And furthermore, that the sovereignty of the smaller states around Russia, as well as their territorial integrity, is contingent, disposable, and just a matter of expediency. And that the treaties, and there's a whole list of them, that Russia has signed, guaranteeing their sovereignty, integrity, etc., are, to use a phrase that was in vogue 100 years ago, a scrap of paper. Now, this is not a Putin invention. Russia believes there are only two or three sovereign states, maybe the European Union, China, US, and Russia. The rest are not really sovereign. They are members of some sort of alliance system. And the world is really divided into bipolarity. Great powers, by definition, create their own bloc, and all the smaller states have to revolve around their orbit, to use Dmitry Trenin's metaphor from 10 years ago. And this is an attitude that goes back, if not to the Tsars, certainly to the Soviets. Let me remind you that 1920, Stalin writes about the borderlands, that if they are not pro-Soviet, they will be pro-imperialist. There's no third way. In other words, if you're not subordinate to Russia, if you're not part of the Russian imperial formation, you are hostile to Russia. There is no neutrality. And furthermore, not one state east of Germany enjoys sovereignty, or undisputed territorial integrity as far as Russia's concerned. Russian ambassadors, and I've written a lot about this and you can track it down, like to make statements in the countries to which they are accredited, not just in Europe, but also in Central Asia Caucasus, that quite frankly, Russia has a right of intervention in their domestic affairs. Therefore, Russia believes that the fundamental policy goal is the recognition by the West of this great power status. It believes that the United States is now trying to thwart it, but is increasingly unable to do so, in decline, weak, and led by a leadership that is weak, decadent, and corrupt. Now, that perception owes a lot to Russia's projection of its own values onto the United States. It believes that all the talk about values is pure hypocrisy, that nothing counts but power. This is a kind of ultimate nihilism. It's something out of Nietzsche's will to power, if you like, that that's the only force that's out there, and that everything else is just window dressing and hypocrisy. But what really counts is power and will. The strategy is, therefore, to create situations that reinforce global bipolarity, that bring Russia equal to the United States as it was in 1945. And if you read some of the more recent statements by Lavrov and Putin, they clearly state as much. And that recognize Russia as a system forming power in this multipolar world, which is to be constructed at American and Western expense. There is to be a frank acknowledgement of spheres of influence, and they don't believe in anything other than power. Now, as I said, this is a Russian elite consensus. To give you an example, in 1996, when I was a professor at the Army War College, we were asked to support the biennial conference of European security institutions that was held in Moscow. The condition was that I go over. We got there. The first session, organized by the host state, the Russian speaker got up and said, well, we see Europe in the following way. And remember, 1996, Russia's prostrate. There is NATO, led by the United States. And then there is the CIS, led by Russia. In other words, all these states were nothing more than creatures of Russia. We speak for Kazakhstan, for Uzbekistan, for Ukraine, and so forth. The Ukrainian delegate got up and said, thank you very much, but we intend to make our own mistakes. Unfortunately, they did. Now, that kind of thinking, if anything, has congealed. It's hardened. It's frozen because of the fact that the Russian government cannot conceive of a Russian state other than as an empire. An empire is increasingly the sole viable justification for Putin's regime. So, what does this all mean for the Caucasus and Central Asia? It means, first of all, that the territorial integrity and sovereignty of all those states is open to question. You remember Putin's speech about Kazakhstan last year? That's not an anomaly. It's typical. We've seen in Georgia what can be done, and the exploitation of ethnic and territorial conflicts is a deliberate tactic in order to prevent the consolidation of these states. We see that in regard to Nagorno-Karabakh, and if we want, I can give you details during the Q&A. So every conceivable conflict within these countries or between them is to be exploited for the greater glory of Moscow and to keep them off balance, divided, and to therefore, at the same time, Russia will use all the instruments of power, diplomacy, information, military power, economic power, in order to keep these people somewhat destabilized, to find the cadres in these governments that are pro-Moscow, and this is the historic tactic of the Tsarist Empire, to always find the pro-Russia guy, whether it's Poland or Kazakhstan, and work with them to co-opt them and then bring the whole country in, or at least part of the country. We have all kinds of forms of economic warfare, trade boycotts, energy boycotts, wine boycotts, sanitary physical boycotts, cutting off migrant remittances when you like, and so on, just to let people know who's boss. Information warfare, the deliberate employment of a strategy using Russian-speaking diaspora, not necessarily, quote, ethnic Russians, but Russian speakers. So, for example, if I wanted to, I could be included in this, and my grandparents, if they were still alive, would be part of the Russian Ruski Mir, much against their will, I might add. And, you know, therefore they could claim also Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, if you, although I would recommend not going into New York. The point here is that the tactics aim at the strategic goal of steadily widening Russia's sphere of discretion in the former Soviet Union and in compromising the foundations of these states, whether it is Tajikistan or the Baltic states, that they are not to be truly independent. They might be juridically independent, but in practice, that independence and their territorial integrity will always be compromised and have a question mark over it. Russia, in the Caucasus and Central Asia, has made it clear to everyone it intends to be the military hegemon, no questions asked. It is on the verge of intervening in Central Asia if the Taliban or ISIS cross out of Afghanistan, and they are extremely anxious about this, and they have actually said so, that they are thinking about intervention if necessary. They are therefore ready to attack, as we've seen in Georgia and Ukraine, and potentially in Kazakhstan. Territorial revisionism is never far away and can be exploited or threatened in order to whip states into line. Ethnic issues can be exploited, not just Russians. Last year, we suddenly saw people talking about the ethnic oppression of the Karakalpaks in Uzbekistan, out of nowhere. Not that the Karakalpaks are not being oppressed, but suddenly Russia developed a tender solicitude for these people, which had previously not been visible. Furthermore, we see, therefore, as an overall series of tactics towards the strategic goal of enhancing Russia's domination of this sphere of influence, the use of all these instruments of power in a constant, unrelenting pressure. What you have to understand is that Russia is essentially conducting political warfare, as George Kennan defined the term almost 70 years ago, on a daily basis. As far as Russia is concerned, it is constantly under siege and acting accordingly. This is the rejection into our time of the Leninist threat paradigm, minus talk about classes, but that there's imperialism and socialism, and there's a constant struggle, even if it's not necessarily military, military forces prominently in the background and may be deployed as necessary. Therefore, what we have to understand is that what the U.S. military calls phase zero has been underway for years. And by the time we figure out what phase one is, it might be too late. And that Ukraine shows us that. Therefore, in conclusion, the Russian, if you like, Eurasian security architecture project is a dagger aimed at the heart of all the post-Soviet states. It is also a neo-imperialist strategy, which is inherent in the nature of the Russian state, in its genetic code, if you like. And ultimately, that means conflict, even potentially war, and those wars are still going on. And Russia believes if it is not an empire, it will be nothing. So that if they are sufficiently challenged, they will react militarily. And what's more, we cannot count on Putin's good judgment or strategic rationality. Thank you.